definitely have gotten some.
The KBOO Book and Record Sale is back. KBOO's annual book and record sale happens Saturday, September 28th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Not only will there be fabulous books, CDs, and vinyl to grab at ridiculously low prices, but it will also be a madcap fun community event. There will be KBOO DJs spinning live all day and baked goods available for a donation. All proceeds from the day benefits KBOO, your community radio station. It all happens at the Musicians Union at 325 Northeast 20th on Saturday, September 28th. That's 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. Questions? Contact Ani at volunteer@kboo.org. For more information, check out kboo.fm.
Classic country and western fans, tune in fourth Saturday of the month from 6 to 9 a.m. for my classic country sound of 60s through 80s country western music. That's fourth Saturday of the month from 6 to 9 a.m., 90.7 FM or kboo.fm on the web.
The time is 5:01 p.m. This is KBOO FM, Portland. And coming up right now is the KBOO Evening News, which has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. Coming up, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Due to financial issues with Pacifica Radio, today will be the final day of Progressive News Show on Free Speech Radio News.
The Oregon legislature on Monday will vote on whether to let local governments decide to allow GMO crops to be grown.
Monday, the Oregon legislature will vote on whether to let local governments decide whether to allow GMO crops.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 27th, 2013. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Only two genetically modified crops are currently grown in Oregon, alfalfa and sugar beets. Under current Oregon law, local governments can prohibit farmers in their jurisdictions from growing GMO crops. This Monday, the Oregon State Legislature will vote whether to allow local governments to continue to have this power. Environmental groups generally oppose the measure. They worry that GMO crops can cross-pollinate with other or otherwise contaminate nearby organic plants. For more on the story, KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke with Oregon Environmental Council Representative Angela Crowley-Cook.
Right now, local governments can ban growing genetically modified crops, but the Oregon State Legislature will be voting on Monday not to let local governments make this decision. Why do you find this to be problematic?
Well, there's a few reasons this is problematic. First of all, GMOs are not regulated by the state of Oregon, and the federal regulations are not that great. And so to preempt local jurisdictions from addressing these issues before there are any other rules in place is really putting the cart before the horse. With GMOs, we know there have been issues of contamination of organic crops, and that can really cause a serious economic hardship for those farmers. Oregon has one of the strongest number of organic farmers. It's extremely high when compared with the rest of the country. So it's a pretty big concern. The other issue is really with the process of this entire package that the legislature is deciding on. Each bill should be allowed to either pass or fail on its own and not be tied together with unrelated bills. What happened was the discussions to try and get a deal around PERS and revenue and balancing Oregon's budget stalled out last session. The governor really wanted to see something go through. So in order to get enough Republicans to support the package, this GMO bill was added in to get the number of required votes. And because some Democrats don't want to vote for the PERS bill and some Republicans don't want to vote for the revenue bill, the deal is that all bills have to pass, if any are to pass. And that, we feel, is a pretty undemocratic process and leaves the legislators in a very hard place if they support some bills and not others.
So you sort of touched on this in the first question, but maybe you could elaborate more. What are the potentially harmful effects of allowing GMO crops to be grown in Oregon?
Well, there haven't been really enough testing about GMOs to understand their safety. Most tests have come back that they are safe for consumption, but honestly, we really don't know for sure. And we definitely don't know the impact on the environment of all of these new genetically modified crops. What we do know is that genetically modified crops can contaminate organic crops, and that organic crop that is contaminated no longer has a market. For example, organic alfalfa recently in Washington was rejected when it was found to have been contaminated by GMO alfalfa. And it's not just organic farmers either. Conventional crops can also be harmed. For example, as we saw in eastern Oregon with the wheat, the GMO wheat, that was all conventional wheat that was being grown that was harmed as well.
And how would that happen?
Well, for crops that are either bee or wind pollinated, the GMO crops from a neighboring field can, in some cases, pretty easily contaminate an organic crop or a conventional crop. Corn, for example, is wind-pollinated, and the GMO corn could contaminate crops that are a pretty good distance away.
And finally, what do you think the outcome of Monday's legislative session will be?
You know, it's too early to tell. This one is going to be a nail-biter right to the end. It's unclear if either side has enough votes to pass the bill or kill the entire effort. We are urging legislators not just to vote against the GMO bill, but to vote against all the bills because they are tied together, as we previously talked about. So there's still time to make a difference. Definitely urge your listeners to call their state legislators and ask them to vote against the entire package, and also to call the governor's office and ask them to go back to the drawing board and, you know, don't pick on the environment on an unrelated bill in order to get the package passed.
All right. Well, this is about all the time I have today. But thanks so much for speaking with me, Angela.
Great. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
Oregon's cash-strapped, timber-dependent counties will receive federal aid after Congress passed an extension of the Secure Rural Schools program, which expired last year. Timber-dependent counties in Oregon are short on funding due to a poor timber harvest last year. Oregon will receive a hefty 20 to 30% of the $300 million total going to 41 states. The exact amount each Oregon county will receive isn't available yet, but is estimated to be 5% less than the payments received last year, according to a press release from Senator Ron Wyden's office. Wyden is the chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee that wrote the bill. The bill would fund social programs such as law enforcement and school, while Congress works out a long-term solution to the problem of lower timber tax receipts.
In Multnomah County, a new program has been unveiled which will target adults who solicit minors for sex. District Attorney Rod Underhill unveiled the program yesterday. It came into being after the State Child Abuse Intervention Fund earmarked $150,000 for the effort. Part of the money will be used to help pay for a new prosecutor who will work solely on sex trafficking cases involving minors. The program addresses the need for counseling for victims and perpetrators. It follows on the heels of Senate Bill 673, which makes soliciting a minor for sex a felony rather than a misdemeanor.
More than 200,000 Oregonians will soon receive letters from the state offering them fast-track enrollment onto the Oregon Health Plan. The fast-track option will allow eligible people to enroll in the Oregon Health Plan under the upcoming Medicaid expansion provisions of the Affordable Care Act. The Oregon Health Authority looked through financial data of food stamp recipients and participants in the Healthy Kids program to identify low-income residents who likely will qualify. The Health Authority is now reaching out to these residents through letters being mailed out today. Of those receiving letters, approximately 90% were identified through the food stamp program and 10% through the Healthy Kids program. The letters include the address of a website to contact for more information about the Oregon Health Plan and the Fast Track Enrollment Program. All recipients have to do is send back a completed form in the enclosed envelope, and they'll be enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. This expansion of the health plan is a result of the Affordable Care Act, also called the Obamacare.
A partial government shutdown next week would leave the major parts of the president's Affordable Care Act in place, according to former Democratic and Republican budget officials. Healthcare exchanges for the uninsured will open as scheduled next Tuesday, even if the government shuts down by then. Deleting the money to implement the law, thereby crippling it, is the GOP's dream scenario. But a government shutdown won't make that happen. One reason a shutdown cannot stop the healthcare law is that it's a mandatory program like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, whose funding does not have to be renewed annually by a congressional vote on the budget. During the Clinton-era government shutdown, Social Security brought back nearly 50,000 employees to handle claims work after initially giving them furloughs. Senate Republican leaders called the threat of a shutdown a foolhardy strategy. If the debt limit is not raised by mid-October and the U.S. defaults on its debt, all federal programs, even mandatory ones like Social Security and Medicare, may shut down.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Usually a show focused on women's issues, this week Bread and Roses will be taking a look at men's self-care, interviewing Art Poole and Chris Brocks about dating and divorce from a man's perspective. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy, with a high of 63, and the rain will continue throughout the weekend.
It's 5:14. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Even if that way is devious, unethical, and downright sleazy. All of those adjectives would apply to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's fundraising flimflam. His state has a strict and sensible law to prevent pay-to-play corruption by banning people and corporations that get sizable state and government contracts from giving campaign cash to governors. After all, such cozy give-and-get ties between the top state executive and big-money contractors would be a crass conflict of interest, or, more bluntly, a bribe. The ban is clear-cut, which just as clearly is a problem for Christie. He's trying to sack up big bucks to finance what he hopes will be a huge re-election victory this November, thus positioning him to go after the GOP presidential nomination in 2016. So he definitely has the will to take tainted money from Fat Cat New Jersey contractors who are forbidden to give it, but what's the way? A ricochet shot, of course. Sure enough, in May, a covey of contractors joined their governor for a fundraiser at a Jersey golf resort and forked over checks of as much as $100,000 each. The checks were not made out to Governor Slick, though, but to the Republican Governors Association, an outfit he's in line to chair if he gets reelected. In the first half of this year, Christie and his political cohorts helped the RGA collect nearly $1.7 million from New Jersey donors, including state contractors. And here comes the ricochet. So far, the RGA has pumped $1.7 million into Christie's reelection efforts. Neat trick, huh? I don't view it as a workaround, sniffed a contractor who donated at Christie's fundraiser. I view it as making a contribution to the RGA. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure you do, and I view the whole flock of you as sleaze birds.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Corporate spending has been affecting elections and policy for decades. However, recently corporations have become more open about their spending, according to a report by the Center for Political Accountability. KBOO's Peter Schoaf spoke to the center's director, Bruce Fried, about corporate political spending.
Bruce, could you tell me a little bit about the Center for Political Accountability and the Index of Corporate Political Accountability and Disclosure that your organization produces?
Our mission is to bring transparency and accountability to corporate political spending. We've led the effort to achieve disclosure and accountability. You know, it was not on the agenda of companies 10 years ago. Today, it's squarely on the agenda of companies and their directors. There's been tremendous progress. There's a great deal of more work to do, and it's one of the most critical issues facing companies, public, shareholders, and our democracy. The center has been doing the index for the past 3 years to benchmark companies on their political disclosure and accountability policies. We consider that important to be able to really spot the trends in how companies are handling this very important area. Political spending today poses a very serious risk to companies. They're under tremendous pressure to give. There are increasing, you know, groups or ways for companies to spend money secretly, and it's very important that companies adopt good corporate governance policies to be able to assure that their spending is done transparently and in a way that does not pose a risk, and in a way also that is in line with good corporate governance practices. The index is a way to benchmark companies on the policies and practices that they have, and it helps both companies, investors, the public, the media, to be able to know, you know, what companies are doing. I think what's important to realize is that the disclosure that's being asked of companies is you know, of their spending, you know, where disclosure today is not required. Trade associations and 501c4 groups are not required to report their donors, and that leaves a wide range of secrecy that can pose very serious risks.
How does the Corporate Political Accountability Disclosure Index help investors?
So it can, you know, help an investor, you know, make a decision on engaging a company to change its policies. That's a very important area where you have you know, activist shareholders who are looking to change company behavior, and they can use the corporate governance process to do that.
In your report, the CPA revealed that corporations are becoming more transparent. Why do you think that that's happening?
I think companies are doing it for several reasons. One is that it's good corporate governance. I mean, there are many companies that consider good governance to be good business. And companies also see transparency and accountability as in their self-interest. You know, it can protect the company from the type of pressure to give. And the protection comes from having policies that executives can cite, you know, when they're asked to engage in political spending. So it allows a company to decide when to do something and when not to do something.
So with the increased disclosure and accountability, do you think that speaks to the American climate that we're more okay with political spending?
I think there are concerns among the public about the type of spending that you have today. I mean, it clearly is reflected in public opinion surveys. I think, you know, the whole movement for political transparency and accountability by companies, you know, reflects, you know, a company response to the concerns that are both public and also from shareholders.
I was speaking with Bruce Fried, director of the Center for Public Accountability. For KBOO News, I'm Peter Schoff.
Today marks the final daily broadcast of Free Speech Radio News. On September 13th, the FSRN Board of Directors issued a two-week notice to all staff. The layoffs come after years of cuts and a shrinking budget. The financial difficulties are tied to Pacifica, the primary funder of Free Speech Radio News. For more, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Russell Gregg, treasurer of FSRN's Board of Directors.
Russell, with today being the final broadcast of Free Speech Radio News as our listeners have come to know it over the years, can you talk briefly about some of the events that led up to today's broadcast?
Free Speech Radio News has always relied primarily on funding from the Pacifica network, and as their financial crises have gone on over the last several years, those have impacted us to the point that currently they are indebted to us to the tune of approximately $200,000. We have negotiated reductions in their monthly payments to us, but we haven't seen anything from them in several months, and our bank accounts have been depleted.
So now, over the last couple of years, there have been several, let's call them false alarms, where you guys have released a deadline to your listeners that if we don't raise X amount of dollars before this day, then we're going to have to shut down our broadcast. During those situations, was it listeners that bailed you out? And what was happening behind closed doors regarding discussions with Pacifica during those really critical moments over the last couple of years?
Yes, it has been listeners that have kept FSRN on the air. You know, they appreciate the programming that we provide and will step up. We considered going to the listeners again with this latest crisis, but honestly, this was something that we did in the spring, and we felt like we couldn't ask them to do that again. In terms of behind closed doors, I mean, what we have done is try to set up a payment schedule with Pacifica that they would be able to meet. We have negotiated in good faith with Pacifica, and we do believe that the Pacifica network, you know, values FSRN and wants to see it continue, but they have they do have a lot of fiscal issues that they need to address.
Why not solely produce a newscast that is completely dependent on listener donations and independent from Pacifica?
We are currently exploring other funding methods, other distribution methods, and other programming options. Nothing presently is off the table. We have a number of irons in the fire and a number of things that we've wanted to explore further over the last couple of years, but it's always been every time we want to start developing alternative funding models, we get into another financial crisis and all of the scant resources that we have are immediately diverted into emergency fundraising. So, you know, with us going dark for, you know, hopefully a limited amount of time, this will allow the volunteer board of directors and the steering committee to explore alternate ways of keeping the program going where the Pacifica Foundation is not the primary source of our revenue.
Has there been difficulties on FSRN's board in decision-making processes in regards to the financial situation, specifically an inability to come to a consensus?
No, I would not say so. I've sat on a number of boards for different media organizations over the years, and I find the FSRN board to be very professional and able to have a larger vision.
How would you do things differently so you don't face the same kind of problems that Pacifica is facing?
In some ways, that's comparing apples and oranges in terms of, you know, a large part of Pacifica's issues are surrounding infrastructure, rent and broadcast towers and things that, you know, a news program doesn't necessarily have to deal with. From a purely fiscal point of view, I believe that, you know, we need to be in a situation where we have a wide range of revenue streams coming in, whether that's, regular funding drives, strong relations with affiliate stations, potentially foundation money, as opposed to, you know, one revenue stream representing the lion's share of our funding.
What are some of your plans going forward now that, you know, with today being the last broadcast, you are going dark?
We are exploring alternate sources of funding, whether that is foundations, whether that is working directly with community stations, and whether that's expanding our target beyond the continental United States. We are exploring alternate visions for getting the programming out. So perhaps a 5-day a week, 30-minute newscast is not sustainable, but perhaps a 1-hour weekly news magazine is. Perhaps regular headlines, shorter newscasts supplied multiple times a day to our affiliates is sustainable.
That was Russell Gregg, board treasurer for Free Speech Radio News. Summer Reese, the interim executive director for Pacifica, told KBOO Today that Pacifica and Free Speech Radio News are continuing negotiations and Pacifica hopes to work with FSRN in the future as it undergoes restructuring.
For one last story from FSRN, they report a major UN climate change report released today found that human influence is the dominant cause of climate change and calls for substantial and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in order to avoid serious consequences. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report outlines alarming trends in warming oceans, increasing droughts and heat waves, and rapid sea level rise. For more, we're joined by Mina Rahman, the climate change negotiations expert with Third World Network. She's in Stockholm, where the meetings have been taking place this week.
Well, I think it is quite clear that we have to take dramatic action now and very radically. The one thing that really stood out for me was that a clear statement from the IPCC that to stay below 2 degrees C, we cannot emit more than 1,000 gigatons of carbon, and with 54% has already been emitted. So there's a very clear indication that we have to do substantial decrease of greenhouse gases.
So with that carbon budget, as you're describing, a budget of 1,000 gigatons of carbon, as you noted, more than half has already been put into the atmosphere. So where are we on that path, and how does that relate to this limit of degree rise that the scientists are warning about?
Yeah, well, first, I think many of us are quite concerned that at the moment the concentration here is on the 2 degrees target, while many of us actually feel that we should stay below 1.5. So what this actually means is that we don't have any time left to not act. So substantial changes have to happen. And I think the importance of the fifth assessment report is very key in the climate negotiations, where there isn't a new agreement that is being discussed right now. But many of us feel that these are actions that ought to have been taken longer, earlier, and not wait for an agreement in 2020.
So in terms of response, as the international talks move ahead, also some nations have taken action or change their policy. In Australia, their new government said it is actually ending plans to impose a carbon tax. France recently announced that it will begin a fossil fuel tax next year. Are there meaningful policies that you see countries doing on their own?
Well, it's very unfortunate to hear what has happened in Australia, but it's encouraging to hear what the French are doing. There has to be policy responses immediately, which are really concrete. For instance, in the United States, it's unfortunate that they've moved to fracking instead of really trying to curb the emissions much more radically. So I do think that for the international negotiations, it's very clear that we have been calling out that the developing world, for instance, can change the way they produce energy, can change a lot of the move away from all types of energy systems or buildings and so on. But that requires money. And what's really worrying is that that money is not on the table. Even there is going to be a meeting of the Green Climate Fund next week, which I will go for. And what we see there happening is that there's no money, no resources. The Green Climate Fund doesn't have resources to respond to the needs of developing countries now.
So at the meeting of the Green Climate Fund next week, other international talks later this year, Mina Raman, you're highlighting the need for financing. Another aspect of this report released today, UN scientists concluded that most of the aspects of climate change will continue for centuries, even if CO2 emissions are stopped. So what would developing nations be able to do in response to climate change with funds? Why are they so crucial at this stage?
Most immediately, they will be able to respond to adaptation needs. They will be able to put in place, responses to prevent sea level rise or cope with sea level rise, allow the poor people to become far more resilient in terms of housing and agriculture systems and so on, so that when you have a flooding happen, they know what to do. So these are the kinds of immediate adaptation responses that are really, really important, which is absolutely critical, so that people put in place systems that are able to cope with the climate impacts that we will see and which are going to be happening, as the report tells us. It's already happening now. It's going to be far more frequent in terms of heat waves, droughts, floods, extreme events, and so on. The second, of course, is developing countries can also take action to make sure that they don't follow the wrong energy systems and models, so that they move away from fossil fuel dependence. They have the ability to put solar, wind, renewable energies, reduce emissions from agriculture of the wrong kind. So there's a lot they can do. They can protect their forests. So, but what's really needed is money on the table now with urgency. So So we hope that will happen with this new report.
Mina Rahman is the climate change negotiations expert with the Third World Network. She joined us from Stockholm, where UN scientists released the most recent climate change assessment today. Mina Rahman, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani declared that no country had the right to a nuclear arsenal and demanded that Israel sign the 1979 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Since arriving in New York for meeting at the UN, President Rouhani has been engaged in a vigorous campaign to present a newly moderate face and insist Iran is serious about rejecting nuclear weapons. Following a meeting of Iran's foreign minister with the UN Security Council on Iran's uranium enrichment program, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry welcomed what he said was a change in Iran's tone, but added that there's a lot of work to be done. At another venue on disarmament at the UN, Rouhani said, quote, "No nation should possess nuclear weapons, since there are no right hands for these wrong weapons," unquote. Noting Israel's failure to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Mr. Rouhani said that all nations, including Israel, should be subject to unfettered inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, something the U.S. has long demanded of Iran. According to a report by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists 2 weeks ago, Israel has about 80 nuclear warheads, with enough nuclear material for 100 more. Israel has warned the U.S. not to take the Iranian president at face value, because he is subordinate to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu ordered the Israeli delegation to boycott Mr. Rouhani's speech to the UN General Assembly, referring to Iran's gestures as a smokescreen.
In the latest news on U.S. casualties in Afghanistan, 3 U.S. servicemen were killed in the past several days. 31-year-old Army Staff Sergeant Thomas A. Bashore was shot yesterday in an attack on his unit in Patkia province. Also in the Middle East, 2 Navy members were killed in a helicopter crash in the Red Sea. Chief Warrant Officer Jonathan S. Gibson and Lieutenant Commander Landon L. Jones were both members of Helicopter Sea Combat Squadron 6, based out of San Diego, California. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Carl Fisher, Peter Schoaf, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Jennifer Kemp. Special thanks to the reporters from Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer tonight is Ian Gadberry. The interim KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste and Cecil present the third in a series of programs on the Affordable Care Act. Today's show focuses on workers and the new health insurance exchanges. The guests are Jim McGee of the Transit Employees Health and Welfare Fund and Peter Shapiro, local organizer with Jobs with Justice. At 9, The Old Mole presents incisive and critical commentary on Syria, Obamacare, the impending government shutdown, food stamps and class, and more. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines interviews and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein features a conversation with author Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. And at 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall speaks with chiropractor lobbyist Vern Sabo about the recent progress in expanding health care, public health care, to offer what has been called alternative care. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not currently a member, you can change that by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Usually focused on women's issues, this week Bread and Roses will look at men's self-care, interviewing Art Poole and Chris Brox about dating and divorce from a man's perspective. Have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the centerpiece of the Affordable Care Act will launch October 1st, but do the millions of Americans who qualify for the insurance exchanges have any idea what they're facing? If they do, that's little thanks to media, who until lately have been underserving the consumer angle on this consumer story. We'll hear from healthcare journalist Trudy Lieberman of Columbia Journalism Review. Also on the program, to many in the corporate media, Barack Obama's UN General Assembly speech signaled a retreat from militarism. This interpretation seems largely based on Obama's softer, more diplomatic tone regarding U.S.-Iran relations. But was diplomacy the gist of the president's UN speech? We'll talk to peace activist and War is a Lie author David Swanson about that. All of that's coming up. NBC's Chuck Todd raised eyebrows when he seemed to suggest that clarifying misinformation about the Affordable Care Act was not journalists' job, but Obama's. There are challenges to reporting an issue in which disinformation and confusion are widespread, but reporting that confines itself largely to talk of messaging, pro or con, is of little practical use. As the launch date for the insurance exchanges at the Act's heart approaches, we are seeing more fact sheets. But can media make up for the long period in which they told the story of Obamacare as a matter of some say, others differ? Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor at Columbia Journalism Review and lead writer on their healthcare desk, The Second Opinion. She joins us now by phone from Montreal. Welcome back to Counterspin, Trudy Lieberman.
Thank you. It's always good to be on your show.
Well, the public is getting a fair serving of misleading or incomplete information, not just from ideological opponents who are saying it's all an unmitigated disaster, and White House officials who are saying, oh, it's as easy as booking a flight, but also, as you've noted, from other players like insurance companies and brokers and more. Back in July, you wrote that readers and viewers would be eternally grateful if journalists would help them find their way through this liftoff. Is that happening?
Okay. I think that this story has been covered to death. And there have been zillions and zillions of words written about the Affordable Care Act. But for some reason, these words have really not helped the public understand what this thing really is. And all we have to do is look at the polls to see how dismal the results have been. I mean, most people don't understand it. They don't like it, but they don't really know why they don't like it, and they don't know if and how it will affect them. And I think that is probably a failure of the press as well as a failure of the politicians who really sort of led the press in covering this from the very beginning. So much of the coverage that we've seen over the years has been really the horse race, the political coverage, and so on. I think the story has shifted now to a focus on the consumer, the person who will have to go to these exchanges. One of these 24 million people the Affordable Care Act was all about. So I think that this has become an old-fashioned consumer story the kinds of stories that old reporters like me used to do in the days of Ralph Nader and through the 70s and 80s. What I've done on the CJR website, it's really a how-to for reporters and for the public to kind of walk through the decision points one has to make when going to your state exchange. And it doesn't matter whether your state is running it or the federal government is running it. It is a very complicated shopping decision. It is not like buying a plane ticket to Paris. It's not as much fun as buying a plane ticket to Paris. What I do in that piece is lay out step by step what people have to know and think about. And the trade-offs are very difficult. There will be lots of policies available. And instead of worrying about whether there's going to be low premiums or high premiums, the premiums are going to be what they are. And there will be low premiums for some people, and there are going to be high premiums for some people. And that's going to depend a lot on your age, your family size, where you live, what kind of policy you're going to buy, whether you're going to be satisfied with a cheapy policy, a bronze model, I like to call them, that covers only 60% of your costs, or a better one that covers 90 or 80% of your costs.
So you're saying reporters are not helping much by asking generic questions about, will premiums be lower or higher? It's really the time for specific, concrete information about the variety of options people are going to have and, you know, the various things they need to think about as they make those choices.
Absolutely. I don't think it matters at all whether last year's premiums are lower or higher than this year's. They're not even the same policies in that particular market. So those kinds of comparisons are fallacious to begin with. And unfortunately, a lot of public officials have been making them. It's also equally wrong to say that rates are just going to go through the roof. In Ohio, they were predicting rate increases of 88%. Well, they're probably going to be pretty high rates in Ohio, but not in the neighborhood of 88%. And in Ohio, the reason is that they've had very little regulation to begin with. So when you bring in some of the regulation in Obamacare, that's going to raise premiums in many places. So what we really have here is a very complicated shopping task for people. And to blow it off, I think, is doing the public a real disservice. Consumers are misunderstanding the difference between copayments and coinsurance. And this is probably the most crucial thing